Morning, everyone. Today's daf is Baba Kama, daf of the test. We are holding at the bottom of Pei Ches Amid Beis, four lines up from the bottom. Elamayin Adom Mishnah Seinu. The Gemara is going to continue on with the discussion of the story of the mother of Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba, the wife of Rabbi Abba, who sold her ksuba to her son, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba, and then she passed away, and we have to figure out who deserves to get the ksuba. Should it be Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba, the son? Should it be Rabbi Abba, the husband? And the Gemara is going to discuss why it's not similar to the Mishnah that we brought of a father who sells, or a son really, or father, I guess, who sells a field that was promised to the son. And then the Gemara is going to continue on based on the answer to that question about Takanas Usha, a certain institution that they made in Usha, and how that relates to our Mishnah, which said that a Eved Ve'isha is Piyasan Ra, that a slave or a woman have sort of a detrimental aspect to them, which is that if you injure them, you have to pay. And if they injure you, they do not have to pay. Do we have a question before we
start? Yeah, I asked this yesterday, and I'm still waiting to see how this develops. The Divrei Amaschal of this Gemara was the two dots.
Yeah,
yesterday. Bottom up. And then the Gemara does a whole dog and pony show about the sale of the father to the son and the question about whether it works or not. There's no mention yesterday, there's no mention today about any chayr shaytiv katan issues.
Right.
So keep that in mind. Keep that in mind, and maybe we can, maybe we'll bump into it at some point.
Yeah. So it sounds like we'll bump into it at some point. I'm struggling to find the previous Mishnah that we've been speaking about, but the Mishnah also mentioned, here it is, I think on Pei Zayin Amud Aleph, right before chayr shaytiv katan, where is it? Right after chayr shaytiv katan, it says, Avid Ba'isha P'kiyasan Ra. And that's really what we're discussing, and the Gemara is going to discuss that today. So I wonder, I don't know, depending on the different Gemaras that we have, maybe that two dots that you're mentioning, which says Cher Shot and Katan, and doesn't seem to elaborate on that, maybe there's supposed to be a V'chule there. That's really supposed to be, right? Sometimes you have that change made that is really supposed to be going on the continuation of Mishnah. But certainly something to keep in mind. So let's pick up the bottom of Peches on the base, four lines from the bottom, Elamai. So ask the Gemara, Elamai in a Domu Mishnah Seinu. How is it that the case of the mother of Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba selling her ksuba to her son, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Abba, is not similar to this Mishnah about a child who is supposed to receive the field of his father and sold it? So the Gemara answers, Mishum Takanas Usha. The reason these cases aren't comparable, the case of a husband and wife and the case of a father and a son, is because of a certain institution that they made in Usha. The Amar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, because Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina tells us, Be'usha Yidkinu, in Usha, they made a certain institution that Ha'isha Shemachra Benichse Melug B'chaye Baila Umesa Habal Motzi Miyad Halakuchos. What they instituted in Usha is that if a woman sells the Nichse Melug, really her own or her husband's, I'll explain in one second exactly what that means, while her husband is still alive, and then she dies, the husband could be Motzi Miyad Halakuchos. That if she sells Nichse Melug while the husband is living and she dies, that sale is considered to be invalid, and the husband can go and take that property from the person who bought it. So just to explain a tiny bit, the Mishnah and Gemara,
they usually make the takana, and they give a reason why it was necessary to make the takana. What was the reason here?
She sold away his rights.
You're right. She sold away his rights.
No, but it's a takana. Ordinarily, a wife, if it's Nifse Maluk, she can sell it.
Right.
Here they said, no, the husband gets it. There must have been a reason why they did this. If ordinarily a woman owns her own property, why did they make a change in this case?
Right, so I'm going to try to explain the property rights of the husband and the wife in one second. Rashi just tells us here that the reason for this institution is Mishum Eva, that they didn't want to breed contempt between the husband and wife. So to some degree, which I'll explain in one second, the husband does have certain rights in the Nichse Milug of the woman, even though technically they're the woman's. So it would cause, you know, consternation. It would cause a rift in the marriage if we allowed the woman to sell the property. So in Usha, they instituted that you should no longer do that and that the husband could be motzi miyad halakuchos if the woman dies.
When the husband married her, he knew she had these were Nifse Maluk. He knew what the conditions were, and he married her anyway.
But he gets to pay Ros.
Yeah, so let me just clarify that point.
Maybe he can still get to pay.
Yeah, but he gets to pay Ros, and if she predeceases him, he would own it. He inherits the wife.
So yeah, just to clarify that point, what the Gemara and Mishnah describe in Ksubis is that there are two types of property that the woman brings into a marriage. There's Nichsei Tzon Barzel, which we assume ironclad property, and then there's Nichsei Milud. So the dinim of those two types of property is that Nichsei Tzon Barzel is property that's valued when it's brought into the marriage, and the husband takes full responsibility over it, that it's going to leave the marriage at the same value at which it comes into the marriage. So if it increases in value, then it increases in his advantage. And if it decreases in value, it also decreases to his disadvantage. He would have to make up for that loss in value. Nichsei Milug, we assume, come into the marriage and leave the marriage exactly as they are, completely unchanged. The only difference is that the Baal gets to eat the peros. So if a woman brings in a field, which we assume is Nichsei Milug, then the husband could eat the produce of that field. So to answer Fred's question, and this is really what Rudy was saying, the reason the Chachamim and Usha made this takana is because the husband has certain rights to the property of the Nichsei Milug. He gets to eat the peros. So if a woman can just go and sell them, and there's no penalty for doing so, that's going to be a little bit unfair to the husband, and it's going to cause problems in the marriage. He was expecting that all this Nichsei Milug that would come into the marriage, he would benefit from the fruit, from the peros, and that's no longer the case once she sells it. So in Usha, they had to make this takana, as Rashi tells us, Mishum Eva. So that's why... Yeah.
Again, when the woman sells her Nichsei Milug, the buyer knows or should know that it's Nichsei Milug and that her husband has rights to the fruit. He's buying it with those conditions? No.
No, so I think we're assuming that those conditions will be batel because the husband has the rights to the peros of the Nichsei Milug that's owned by the wife, but he doesn't have the rights to the peros of the Nichsei Milug that are owned by somebody else. So if the woman could just sell them, which prior to Takanas Usha she could have, the husband would lose those rights. And that's why they had to make this institution. So that's going to be why the case of the mother of Shmuel Bar Abba is not similar to the Mishnah, because the Mishnah is not talking about a case that's subject to the Takanas Usha. Takanas Usha only applies to a husband and a wife, which is the case of Rav Shmuel Bar Abba and his father. And that's why, technically, Rav Shmuel Bar Abba, the son, should not get the property, because it's like a woman who's selling the property of her husband or her own property, which the husband has rights to, and then dies during the life of the husband. So the Baal is motzi miyada l'kuchos, and that's why you can't bring any raya's in either direction from the Mishnah about a father and son. So Amar Rav Idi Bar Avin, Afana Nami Tanina, Rav Idi Bar Avin says, we also have an explicit Mishnah which seems to indicate that this Takanas Usha is actually true, is actually relevant. How so? Because the Mishnah tells us, Me'idimanu bish ploni shagiris ish ishto v'notan ksuba. Let's say Edom come and they testify that a certain person divorced his wife and he gave her a ksuba. V'harei hitachtavu mishamashto. But we see the reality is that this woman is still living with the person and is still serving him, still acting as his wife. So it sounds like he didn't really divorce her and he never really gave the ksuba, because the reality seems to contradict the testimony. And then, v'nimtzu zomimim, if the Edom who testified that this person divorced his wife and gave her a ksuba are found to be Edom zomimim, so what's the din? So says the Gemara, Ein omrim yishalmu kol ksubasa. We don't say that these Edom were trying to be mafsid, they were trying to cause the woman to lose out on her entire ksuba, because they testified that she already received it, and therefore she would no longer receive it. Ela tovas hanas ksubasa. We say that they only have to pay for the tovas hana of the ksuba. They don't have to pay for the entire value of the ksuba, because they weren't really trying to be mafsid her the entire ksuba, they were only trying to be mafsid her a marginal amount, a small amount, which would be the tovas hana. So ask the Gemara, ezehu tovas hana ksubasa. What is tovas hana? You told me that there's a smaller amount that they would have to pay, but what exactly is that? Says the Gemara, Om din kam adam rotsa litein b'ksuba shelzu, shim nis armala o nisgarsha, v'yimesa yirashena baila. In order to assess what tovas hana is, we evaluate how much a person would want to pay for this ksuba on the condition that if the woman is divorced or the woman is widowed in a way that she would receive her ksuba, then the person who bought the ksuba will get that value. But if she dies in the life of the husband, then the husband inherits the ksuba. So essentially what the Gemara is outlining is the principle of expected value. We have in financial terms a concept called expected value, that you would pay a certain amount based on how much you think the value that you're ultimately going to get is. So let's say you could receive $100, but only with 60% chance. You should only be willing to pay $60 for that $100, because for the other 40%, you only receive zero. The expected value of this potential $100 is really only $60 to you. So it's the exact same thing by the ksuba. Since in one or two instances, you'll actually receive the ksuba, but in another instance, you'll receive nothing. we have to assess how much value you expect you'll get out of this ksuba, and therefore that'll be how much you're willing to pay. So that's really the only rights that this woman has. The woman wouldn't have necessarily received the whole ksuba, so when the Edom are testifying that she already received it, they're not being mafsid her the entire ksuba, they're only being mafsid her the tovas hana. Now this Mishnah was brought to support the concept of the Takanas Usha. This was supposed to prove that we do have a Takanas Usha. So the Gemara says, how do we see that from this Mishnah? V'isal kadaitach leisa le Takanas Usha, amay yirashen abayla, taz bin ksubasa legamre. If you think that there is no Takanas Usha, that we don't have an institution that basically stops a woman from selling the Nichsei Milug in such a way where we say that the husband, if the woman dies in the husband's lifetime, that the husband could be motzi miyara lekuchos, then why do we assume that if she dies, the husband inherits the ksuba? She should be able to sell the ksuba legamre. So the fact that the Mishnah said that the tovas hana, the expected value of the ksuba, is how much you'd be willing to pay on condition that if the woman dies in the life of the husband would just inherit the ksuba, that shows that we must hold of Takanas Usha, because that's essentially saying that even if the woman sells property that the husband has some rights to, if she dies in the life of the husband gets to collect it. The person who bought that property or bought those rights does not get to collect it. So this Mishnah seems to be a clear proof that the Takanas Usha is true. But Abaye is going to come along and reject that. Amar Abaye, no, im amru b'nichsei milug, yomru b'nichsei tzon barzel. Abaye says this Mishnah doesn't show that Takanas Usha is true. Because even if Takanas Usha is true, it doesn't necessarily follow that the Takanas Usha should apply to the Ksuba. Why not? Because if they made a Takanas Usha by Nichsei Milug, would they necessarily say that you could sell Nichsei Tzon Barzel? And the Ksuba here we're assuming is Nichsei Tzon Barzel. So when the Mishnah says that if the woman were to die in the life of the husband would inherit the Ksuba, that doesn't necessarily show you that Takanas Usha is true. Maybe Takanas Usha is not true, and you can sell Nichsei Milug, but you cannot sell Nichsei Tzon Barzel. So that which the Mishnah is telling us, that if the woman dies in the life of the husband inherits the property, maybe doesn't prove Takanas Usha at all. It's really just because we're dealing with a different type of property. We're dealing with Nichsei Tzon Barzel, which, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, comes into the marriage and leaves the marriage at the exact same value. If it increases in value, the husband benefits from that. But if it decreases in value, the husband has to be mashlim, has to complete the value of the item as much as it was worth when it came into the marriage. So this Mishnah doesn't necessarily show us that Takanas Usha is true. Maybe a woman can sell the Nichsei Milug, and the husband does not inherit it if she dies in his lifetime, but she cannot sell the Nichsei Tzon Barzel, and that's why the husband would inherit the ksuba in this case if the woman were to die in the life of the husband. So now says the Gemara, Amar Abaye, Tovas Hana, Hola V'Asa Liyadon, Neima B'Milta. Abaye says, a topic that just came up in conversation here, we are speaking about Tovas Hana, which we said is essentially expected value. How much am I willing to pay such that I'll get the ksuba if the woman is divorced or widowed, but I will not get anything if the woman dies in the life of the husband? So says Abaye, since we're discussing Tovas Hana, why don't we say an additional thing about Tovas Hana? Tovas Hana li'isha havya. The Tovas Hana of a ksuba is going to belong to the woman. How do I know that? De'isal kadayetuch le'baal havya, because if you think that the Tovas Hana should belong to the husband, then in this case of Edim Zomimim that we just mentioned, le'mer le'edim mai afsadinach. The Edim should tell the woman, when they were testifying that she already received their ksuba, and the Mishnah said they should only have to pay the Tovas Hana, but they should not have to pay the entire ksuba. Why don't they tell the woman, "My afsadinach, what did we cause you to lose? Yihavat mazbina letovas hana, bal havashakim minach. If you had sold the ksuba for tovas hana, then the husband would have received the tovas hana." So Abaye says, if the Edom could make such a claim, that would show you that the tovas hana really belongs to the husband. The fact that the Edom cannot make a claim that they didn't cause the woman to lose out on anything, and they have to pay her the tovas hana, shows you that the tovas hana really belongs to the woman, not to the husband. So Abaye says, we're discussing tovas hana. I have a clear proof about tovas hana that it belongs to the woman. But again, this proof is rejected. Amar of Salman, Mishum de'ika ravach besa. Salman says, maybe you're wrong. Maybe the tovas hana doesn't really go to the woman. And the reason the Edom cannot make such a claim of my afsadinach is the woman could say, even though the tovas hanah goes to the husband, I'm still losing out by you guys trying to be masid me, the tovas hanah of the ksuba, by testifying that I already received it. Because there's ravach besa. If the house, if our household, if my husband receives the tovas hanah of the ksuba and our household increases in value, that's beneficial to me too. So I don't necessarily need to receive the tovas hanah myself in order for you to have been mafsid me something when you testify that I already received the ksuba. Right, let's just see Rashi here quickly.
But then they would have to pay her a fraction of a fraction.
They would have to pay her a fraction of a fraction. You're saying for the ravach besa?
Right.
Okay, but so we could assume that that's the value that they're... Well, yeah, again, why a fraction of a fraction? Because you're assuming the Ravach Besa is less than the actual Tovas Hanah.
The Tovas Hanah would be distributed among members of the household. She would be a beneficiary, but only to...
I don't think it's saying that it'll be split up amongst the household, is it?
Husband would gain from it, your wife would gain from it, the children would gain from it. It's a family that would gain from it.
It's a family that would gain from it, but they're going to gain from it directly because of the value given to the husband. So they're being mafsid that whole value. You could even say the opposite, I think. You could say that it should increase exponentially. If what the Gemara has in mind is Ravach Besa, by getting a little bit more, we can invest that in something and it's going to compound and it's going to be worth even more than that, then maybe she'd receive a multiple of that value rather than a fraction, right? Right, Rashi says, Ravach Besa, afilu im abal notlan, even if the husband gets the value of the Tovas Hanah, noach li'isha lemochra b'chayeha, it's still beneficial for the woman to sell the ksuba for Tovas Hanah, which the husband would get. So that her mizonos, her sustenance, her support will be available at all times in the house. So Mishum Ravach Besa, if the house is going to benefit from the sale of the Tovas Hanah, which the husband will get, then you are being mafsid the woman, and therefore you don't have a clear proof that the woman benefits and gets the Tovas Hanah. It could even be that the husband gets the Tovas Hanah. And nonetheless, the Edom can't say they're not being mafsid or anything because she would still stand to benefit, right? So I hear what you're saying. Potentially, the value of the Tovas Hanah gets split up amongst the household, and therefore it should only be a fraction. But I think at the same time, you could argue that still the entire value benefits the husband, and that indirectly benefits the woman, so you should have to pay that whole value. And you could even argue that she should get way more than that because that, this money will be used.
That you can't argue, because in any case of mumminess where the Edom were found to be Zomimin, you can... use a multiple of whatever they were trying to be mafsid.
Right.
You don't ever find that.
I think you could, and that's why we always say only the whole value. It's always going to be the real value, not a fraction and not a multiple. But you do find in the Gemara for sure, the Gemara says, if I just get a little bit more, then that can increase exponentially, and therefore that's worth something to me. So I'm not saying based on that that you should have to pay, but it's at least maybe an argument why you shouldn't have to pay a fraction. You should only have to pay the real value, because that's the only thing we can necessarily assess. Fine. So that concludes Abaye's discussion on Tovas Hanah. Amar Rava, Hilchata Tovas Hanah Le'isha, Ve'en Abal Ochel Peros. Rava says, the final halacha should be that the Tovas Hanah goes to the woman, like Abaye was trying to say, Ve'en Habal Ochel Peros. And the husband, does not eat the peros. So what does that mean, that the husband would not eat the peros? What that means is we don't say that you have to use the value of the Tovas Hanah, which the woman gets, to buy land and then let the husband eat the fruits of the land. We don't say that. Rather, we just say the woman keeps the Tovas Hanah and the husband seems to get no benefit from it. Why? My time, I asked Gemara, why is that, that we don't say use the money to buy land and the husband will eat the peros? Because pera takinu le rabbanan, pera de pera lo takinu le rabbanan. The rabbanan only instituted that the husband gets to eat the peros of the property of the woman. The husband only gets to eat something which is considered a direct byproduct. If you have a double byproduct, pera de pera, it's something which is already peros, and we're going to use that to buy a field which the husband could then eat the peros of. That the Rabbanan did not institute, that's considered too much of a derivative.
That goes so, directly to your possible answer, that could have grown into a larger sum. We don't say that.
Right, 100%. But at the same time, we shouldn't necessarily say that it should be a fraction. It should just be the true value, right? I hear the pushback 100%, but I think the Gemara is assuming we can't necessarily divide it. The direct Tovas Hanah that the husband gets is the direct increase in value that the woman benefits from. So you shouldn't have to pay a fraction, you should have to pay the whole amount. Now, Ki Asa Rav Papa V'Rav Huna B'Rei D'Rav Yehoshua Mi Be'Rav Amri Tanina le Takanas Yusha. So we saw earlier that we tried to bring a Mishnah which supported Takanas Yusha. That was the Mishnah of Edim Zoamim. The Gemara didn't seem to like that support so much. And now Rav Papa and Rav Huna Breda Rabbi Yeshua, when they came back from the house of Rav, when they came back from the Beis Medrash, they said, we have another Mishnah which seems to support the Takanas Yusha. Ha'eved v'ha'isha p'giyosan ra. And this goes back to our Mishnah and probably answers Moshe's question about why the Gemara is going through this whole discussion now, because the Mishnah had said that a slave and a woman p'giyosan ra, that their injury payments, or really just in general, the whole situation is somewhat contradictory, somewhat detrimental. That if you injure an Eved or an Isha, you would have to pay for that value. But if they damage you, they would be potter, because we assume that they don't really have any property of their own. Mashikana Eved Kana Rabo, whatever a slave owns, whatever a slave acquires, his master automatically acquires. And the woman, we assume that most of her property is considered to be her husband's. If you think that there's no institution of Yusha, that if a woman sells the Nifsei Miluk... What's that? I read that. If you think we don't hold of the institution of Usha, that a woman is allowed to sell the Nifsei Miluk of her husband, and if she were to die in the life of the husband cannot be Motzi Miyad HaLekuchos, then why doesn't she just sell her Nifsei Miluk and she'll use the value that she gets for the Nifsei Miluk to pay off the person that she injured? So that seems to be a clear support for the Takanas Usha. So ask the Gemara, O Taim Ech, Nihinami de Isei LeTakanas Usha, Velo Motzi Mizavna LeGamre. Well, the Gemara pushes back and says, okay, you're trying to use this as a support to prove that Takanas Usha exists. But according to you, even if you assume that Takanas Usha exists, and the woman cannot sell her Nichsei Miluk completely, Tazbin the Nichsei Miluk b'tovas hana b'titenlei. Why doesn't she sell the Nichsei Miluk for the Tobas hana, for the expected value, and use that to pay the person that she injured? Meaning what? The Takanas Usha only applied if the woman dies in the life of the husband. But if the woman does not die in the life of the husband, then the sale will actually be valid. So a person could buy the Nichsei Miluk for expected value and say, if the woman outlives the husband and I will benefit from the property, then this is the value that I'll get. And if the woman does not, the husband is going to take the property and I'll get nothing. So I should pay some certain value, which is the expected value of that acquisition for this. So even if you hold of Takanas Usha, why do we say that the Isha is Pkiyasan Ra, that if she injures somebody, she doesn't have to pay them and you don't receive anything? She should be able to sell her Nifsei Miluk for Tovas Hana, and she should give that to the person that she injured. Answers the Gemara El Delay Slight. It must be that the reason we do not suggest that, the reason we do not have the woman sell the Nifsei Miluk, even if Takanas Usha is true, is because she doesn't have any Nifsei Miluk in the Mishnah's assumption. So Hachanami Delay Slight. And therefore, even... you can even assume that we don't hold of Takanas Usha, and the reason that we don't have the woman sell the Nichsei Miluk for the full value, not for the Tovas Hana, because now we would be assuming that we do not hold of Takanas Usha. So the reason the woman doesn't sell the Nichsei Miluk is because she doesn't have any. So this is not necessarily a good proof that we hold of Takanas Usha.
Just a question.
Yeah.
If an Eved causes injury, is the Baal of the Eved responsible or not?
I think the assumption is not, because the Mishnah says Hachova ben Chai behem shechavu l'ba'achir and peturin. Really, the Eved is responsible, but he doesn't own anything. The owner is not responsible.
It's a tachana, because otherwise, every Eved would get freedom, but he'd go around damaging everything, and the owner of the Eved would have to.
He can impoverish his master. Yeah.
So a later tachana will have to get to that. But as far as the strict letter of the law of the Mishnah, it seems to be that you would not be responsible for the damages of your slave. Where did I go now?
The Tazman,
right? So now the Gemara has another suggestion. Why is it that we say that an Eved, really an Isha, if she damages, she doesn't have to pay? So I understand that she can't sell her Nichsei Miluk, but why doesn't she sell her Ksuba for the expected value of the Ksuba? And she should use that money to pay off the person that she injured. So the answer is the Gemara, Hamani, Rabbi Meir hi, Damar Asr lo la'adam shiyeshe et ishta, afilu sha'achas below Ksuba. The author of this Mishnah is, or potentially the Gemara is just making a suggestion here, that maybe the author of this Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, who says that a person cannot have his wife married to him at any point without a ksuba. So the reason you can't sell your ksuba b'tova sana and give it to the person that you injured is because that would violate Rabbi Meir's gzeira. The Gemara tells us in ksubas that we paskin like Rabbi Meir when he makes a gzeira, and this is one of Rabbi Meir's gzeira, so we have to paskin this way, that it's completely impermissible for a person to be married to his wife at any point without a ksuba. But the Gemara rejects that as a suggestion for why we can't require the woman to sell her ksuba b'tova sana and give to the person as payment for the injury. The time am I, what's the reason that Rabbi Meir says you can't be married to your wife without a ksuba, is kedei shelo tehe kala be'enav leotzia, so that it won't be easy for you to just divorce your wife. We assume that the ksuba has many purposes. One of the purposes is that it's a financial reinforcement to make sure that you won't divorce your wife, because you won't want to have to pay the large sum of money that's promised her in the ksuba. So if the whole reason Rabbi Meir instituted that you have to have a ksuba at all times and you can't be married without a ksuba at any point is so that you won't divorce your wife easily, well, that shouldn't apply here. If the woman sells her ksuba b'tovas hana in order to pay off the damages that she caused, we don't need to worry that that violates Rabbi Meir's concern that you might just divorce your wife willy-nilly. Here, you're not going to divorce her because you know that if you divorce her, the person that she sold the ksuba to is going to come to collect the ksuba. So the exact impetus for Rabbi Meir's gzeira that we don't want you to divorce your wife easily still applies, even if she sells her ksuba b'tovas hana to pay off the value of the damages, and therefore we should suggest that the woman does that in order to pay off the damages. So I think Gemara is going to need a different answer to explain why we don't require the woman to sell her ksuba b'tovas hana. Says the Gemara, el tovas hana mili ninu umili lo mishtabda. We assume that the tovas hana, the expected value of the ksuba, is just considered words. It's not specific property, but it's just sort of an intangible asset, which you can't really sell. And therefore, mili lo mishtabdi, words, intangible assets, are not considered mishuba. They're not considered leaned or bound to the person who bought them. So if you sell the ksuba b'tovas hana, it's not going to be a valid sale, essentially, and that's why we don't require you to do that in order to pay off the damages that you caused. So ask the Gemara, alam alo, well, why is it mili? Why is it considered just something intangible? Why is it considered just merely words? It's mili de mizdabna bidinarinenu. It's words, it's an intangible thing which has a value, which can be sold for money. It can be used for the expected value. So that can't be a good reason why you wouldn't sell the ksuba b'tova sana. Seemingly, this type of mili is different because it actually does have real value. Ela mishum de Shmuel. Says the Gemara, the reason we don't require the woman to sell the ksuba b'tova sana is because of Shmuel. The Amar Shmuel, hamokar shtar chov lechavero b'chazer machlo, machol v'afilu yoresh mochel. The reason we don't require the woman to sell the ksuba b'tova sana is because of the din of Shmuel. Because Shmuel tells us that if you sell a document, you sell an obligation to your friend, and then you go back and you forgive the obligation to the person who owes you money, that would be a valid forgiveness, and the chov, the obligation, would be completely batel. And even an heir of the person who is supposed to inherit that obligation, can also be mochel. So the reason we don't require the woman to sell the ksuba is because we're concerned that the woman will then go back to the husband and tell him, you don't need to pay me the ksuba, and then the person who bought it will lose out. So ask the Gemara, Amri, Zvuni Zabin Betitin Le, Bimachale Legabe Baal, Timchala. I don't understand. This din of Shmuel is that somebody can forgive an obligation to somebody, but they're not automatically going to do it. So why don't we require the woman to sell the ksuba for Tovas Hana and use that money to pay the person that she injured? And if she happens to go and forgive the ksuba to her husband, so she'll forgive it, and there's nothing we can do about that. But we shouldn't necessarily not pay the person that she injured because of this far-off concern. Maybe that's not going to happen.
Don't you then have the problem of Rabbi Meir?
Then you do have the problem of Rabbi Meir.
If she forgives him the ksuba, then she's living with him without a ksuba.
If she forgives him the ksuba, then she's living with him without a ksuba. That's true. But we also would have the problem of the person not getting any value for what, right? The Gemara is saying we don't want to sell the ksuba because of the din of Shmuel. So the Gemara's attack is, well, Shmuel is only a far-off concern, so we don't need to worry about Shmuel. And presumably, like, even though you're pointing out, then you have the concern of Rabbi Meir, we don't have to worry about that either because it's such a far-off concern that the woman will be mochel the ksuba back to the husband. And then that's exactly what the Gemara answers, like you're saying. Amri kol legabe bal vaday machlele v'afsidine lahauzvina biadayim lo afsidine. No, this isn't just a far-off concern. We assume the woman is always going to be mochel the ksuba back to her husband. So we don't want to cause the person who's buying the ksuba b'tova sana to just lose out for nothing. And that would also mean that we'll have the problem of Rabbi Meir. That if she's for sure going to be mochel the ksuba back to her husband, then we have to worry about the fact that they'll be living together without a ksuba. So this suggestion that the reason we don't have the woman sell the ksuba b'tovas hana is because of the din of Shmuel, that she could then be mochel back to the husband, seems to stand at the end of the day. Because, I mean, the Gemara is going to continue on discussing that, but at least right now, we're saying that that's something which will almost definitely happen, and therefore that's going to prevent us from selling the ksuba b'tovas hana. V'chitema, the Gemara says, maybe you'll have a suggestion that zvina ni'alei lahahu dechavlebe b'tovas hana. Maybe you'll suggest that rather than selling the ksuba b'tovas hana to some random person and using that value to pay the person that she injured, maybe she should sell it to the person that she injured b'tovas hana. D'imachole l'gabi mal lo kamafsit t'hashtanami lo midi kayavile. Because now, if the woman goes back to the husband and forgives the ksuba, the person that she injured isn't going to lose out. Because first of all, he would only be paying expected value. And presumably what the Gemara is saying is, he's not even going to pay anything. He's just going to get the expected value of the ksuba as payment for the injury that she caused him. So even if she goes and forgives the ksuba back to her husband, the person who was injured, who's receiving this ksuba b'tovas hana, is not going to lose anything because he's not paying anything for the ksuba. So answers the Gemara, yeah, well, so, kol l'gabi ba'al v'adai machla, v'atshruche beidina b'chti, lo matshrechina. Still, at the end of the day, we assume the woman is definitely going to be mochel the ksuba back to her husband, and even though nobody is going to lose out through this whole process because nobody's paying any money for this ksuba, still it would require us to get Beis Din involved, and we don't want to get Beis Din involved for nothing. This is basically a meaningless process. It's completely wasteful. Nothing is going to come from this. So even though nobody will lose out, we'll at least waste Beis Din time, and we don't want to do that. So says the Gemara,
doesn't the person who's injured lose out?
Well, no, we're assuming the person who injures doesn't lose out. Why? Because the Mishnah already says that the person who's injured gets nothing. So we're suggesting that maybe the person who's injured should get the tovas hana of the ksuba. He doesn't have to pay anything for that. He would just receive that as potential payment for the injuries that were caused to him. So that should be at least better than not giving him anything at all, because there's a possibility that he's going to get something, and he doesn't have to pay for it, so he won't lose out.
And it's not tovas hana either. It would be the full value of the ksuba.
Would it be the full value?
She's giving him the ksuba.
Right, but that's always really just tova sana, because if she were to die in the life of the husband, he might not get it. Yeah. Right, so it's, yeah.
We've learned about an isha and eved. How about a katan?
So the Mishnah also said chayr shot v'katan p'kiyasan ra, that a katan also, you would have to pay the father probably, depending, Mars discussed earlier, if they're smuchin al shulchan, if they're dependent on the father for sustenance, or they're not dependent on the father for sustenance. But the simple understanding would be if they injure you, then they do not have to pay, and neither does the parent.
If he's at the father's table, the father has to pay.
Right.
Isn't he like a katan?
No, not the father.
A gadol samach al shulchan aviv is like a katan.
Right. A gadol samach al shulchan aviv would be like a katan.
So the father would still have to pay?
Why do we differentiate between a katan and an ishan eved? Why do we make a difference?
Because I think in general, just for simplicity, the Gemara assumes that chayr shot v'katan are a distinct category. They're very similar in many ways. And eved and isha also are very similar in many ways, because we assume that an eved is chayv in all mitzvos, that an isha is chayv in, because we learn gzeira shava lala mi'isha. So I think just for consistent structure throughout the Mishnah, it's really in Shas, the Gemara groups chayr shot and katan together, because they seem to be one group, and eved v'isha together, they also seem to be one group.
Joe Blank has opinions on the katan being
chayv. A gadol samach al shulchan ovid, for instance, can't be an eidus, can't serve as an aid.
I'm not so sure. I'm not so...
Can't, because he doesn't... He doesn't appreciate the value of money.
Right, but at the end of the day, is Eidus about appreciating the value of money, or is it just about having das?
I think it's a precondition.
A precondition.
In other words, how can you take seriously a dispute? Someone loses
right,
a
dispute,
money.
But let's
how
say,
do you take it seriously if you don't understand what it means to earn money?
Right, but what about for like Eidei Kiyum by Kiddushin? If we need Eidim to testify that the Kiddushin is valid, even if they don't appreciate the value of money, they're still a ben das, so presumably there they'd be. Mm-hmm. So maybe there are differences in different areas of halacha, a subject for another time. So we have a brisa which says that if a woman injures her husband, she doesn't lose out on her ksuba. So I asked the Gemara, Amai, Tazminina niyale l'ksubasa l'bayla b'tovas hana, b'hachavala, di'imachlo l'gabi ba'al, l'kapseida. So the Gemara says, why is it that a woman doesn't lose out on her ksuba if she injures her husband? We should say that she should sell the ksuba back to her husband b'tovas hana. Meaning, if she were to die in the life of the husband is going to get the ksuba anyway. But she should, so to speak, sell the ksuba back to the husband on the chance that the husband dies or divorces her and she receives the ksuba, then we would let the husband get the value of the ksuba because he's buying it from her, betel vasanav, for the expected value. And then we don't have to worry about Shmuel, because if she forgives the ksuba back to her husband, the husband's not going to lose out on anything because he's the one who would have had to pay the ksuba anyway. So if she's mochalit, he doesn't lose out on anything. So answers the Gemara, and this is really Moshe's point from before. Havada Rabbi Meir, he damar asr la'adam shiyush adishto afilu sha'achas b'lo ksuba. This obviously accords with the opinion of Rabbi Meir that a person cannot be married to his wife without a ksuba even for a second. So if she were to sell the ksuba to the husband, b'tov asana, then, and she were to be mochalit, then they'd be living together without a ksuba, and that would be a major problem. Well, ask the Gemara, at the time am I, kadei shelote kala be'enam leotia, hacha megarishla begabile bechavalamina. Here, meaning the reason that Rabbi Meir says you can't live with your wife without a ksuba is because you might easily divorce her. And here, we actually have that concern in a very magnified way. There's a concern that the husband will divorce the wife and use the ksuba to collect money for the payment of the injuries that were caused to him by the
especially
wife.
Especially if she's beating him up.
Right, especially if she's beating him up. So that's why we can't have the woman sell the ksuba back to the husband, b'tovasana, in order to pay for the damages caused to the husband by the woman, because that would violate Rabbi Meir's gzeira. So ask Gemara, ihachi hashtanami megarish la v'gabi le b'chavalamina, kigon denafish ksubasa, the mishuma hupurta lo mafsin tuva. So Gemara says, well, the whole concern that you're working to avoid is you want to avoid the husband divorcing the wife. But you don't necessarily get around that issue because the husband might still divorce the wife and use the ksuba in order to collect the damages caused to him by the wife. Like, what type of case would exist where the husband would actually do that? If the ksuba is very large, and the Gemara seems to be answering here, can go to nafesh ksubasa, the mishumahu purta, lo mafsid tuva. Gemara answers, we don't have to worry about the husband divorcing the wife, because maybe the ksuba is very large and the payments for the chavala are very small. So the person would never divorce the wife in order to give her property from the ksuba and then collect the value of the damages from that property, from that ksuba, because you're talking about a very small amount. So for example, let's say the ksuba is worth $100 and the damages are only worth $5. So he's not going to divorce her so that he has to give her the $100 so he can then collect $5 for the injuries, because he'd basically be being mafsid the $95 difference. So we assume we don't have to worry about the husband divorcing the wife because maybe the ksuba is way larger than the damages caused to the husband, and he would never come to divorce her in order to collect the damages that were done to him. So I asked the Gemara, Be'ida nefisha ksubasa miksuba del raisa, nokma ksuba del raisa, ve'idach tizbana niale bechavale. Well, everything we're saying is that we don't want the husband and wife to be living together without a ksuba, and potentially the ksuba is so large that the person would never actually divorce the wife in order to collect the value of the damages. But the Gemara says, if the ksuba is really so large, and it's larger than the ksuba that's promised to the woman, mida oraisa, 200 for a betula and 100 for an almana, then why don't we decrease the size of the ksuba? Why don't we say that she should only get the real value of a ksuba del raisa, only the value that's promised her in the Torah, but not the full value that was promised her in this ksuba? And then the discrepancy between those two values can be used to pay for the damages of the husband. So for example, let's say she's a betula, and midoraisa she should have gotten 200, but the ksuba promised her was 500. Why don't we say that she should only get 200, and then use the $300 difference to pay for the value of the damages caused to the husband? So answers the Gemara, going to lo nefisha ksubasa miksuba doraisa. Maybe the situation is that her ksuba is not worth more than the money promised her in the Torah. The havi chavala arba azuze, the mishum arba azuze, lo mafsid esrim v'chamisha. Maybe the Gemara uses the example of an almana, right? Because the Gemara says that it's esrim v'chamisha, it's only 25. And 25 there means 25 sela, which would be 400, which would be 100 zuz, 100 dinar, because there are 4 dinar to a sela. So the Gemara says, yeah, if her ksuba was way more than a ksuba doraisa, then maybe we should use the discrepancy in value, just give her the ksuba d'oraisa, and use the extra value to pay for the injuries. The case must be that her ksuba is not more than the ksuba that's written in the Torah. That maybe the ksuba is the exact 100 that's promised to an almana, but the chavala, the damages caused to the husband, are still very small. It's only 4 zuz, and so the husband would never divorce her in order to collect the 4 zuz of the injury, because he's still going to have to pay the extra 96 zuz, and he wouldn't want to be mafsid that. El ha'detanya kishem shlo timkor behitachtav, kach lo tavsid behitachtav, v'azimnin mishkachla, demifsida, v'heichidami kigon dinafisha ksubasa miksuba d'oraisa. Well, the Gemara says, then how are you going to explain this b'raisa? The b'raisa says that just like the woman is not allowed to sell her ksuba, when she is living and married to the husband. She also cannot be masa de ksuba. We'll have to see exactly what that means, but she can't cause the ksuba to decrease in value when they're still married. But ask the Gemara, there might be cases where the woman is mafsa de ksuba, and the case might be where the ksuba is way more than the ksuba del raisa. Because if the ksuba is way more than the ksuba del raisa, then the extra value may be used to pay for the person that she injured, or potentially the husband. Right? Rashi, kishem shelo timkor, kasalka daita chachi ka'amar. The Gemara is assuming that this is what the Braisa means. Kishem she'ena yechol limkor ba'ode tachtav, just like the woman cannot sell the ksuba while they're still married, kach lo tafsid miksubasa klum bishvil shum chavala benezek shetazik ba'ode tachtav. So too, she can't take away from the value of the ksuba for any injuries that she causes while they're still married. So if we're saying that if the ksuba is way more than the ksuba del raisa, you could use the incremental value, the discrepancy between the value promised in the Torah and the actual value of the ksuba to pay for the value of the damages, then how do we explain the Braisa, which says you can't decrease the value of the ksuba at all? This would seem to be a case where the value of the ksuba is going to decrease in order to pay for the damages that the woman caused. So Amar Rava, the way you understand the Braisa is as follows. Seifa ata asa'an l'ksubas benin dichrin. The seifa of this Braisa is really talking about ksubas benin dichrin. What ksubas benin dichrin is let's say a husband has multiple wives. The wives may have certain different ksubas that they want only their own children to benefit from after the death of the husband, but not the children of the other wives of the husband. So for example, Reuben is married to Rachel and Leah. Rachel's ksuba is worth 500 and Leah's ksuba is only worth 200. Rachel doesn't want the extra value of her ksuba or all the value of the ksuba to go to Leah's children. She only wants it to go to her children. So what's written into the ksuba that's described in the Mishnah and Ksubas, on Nun Beis and Abeis, the Mishnah describes that we make a tnai called Benin Dichrin, where essentially we say, what's going to happen is, let's say Rachel and Leah both die before Reuven, so Reuven's going to inherit their ksubas for the time being, but after the death of Reuven, the money's not going to be split up amongst all the children equally. The money that's owed to Rachel from her ksuba would be split amongst Rachel's children, and the money owed to Leah from Leah's ksuba will be split amongst Leah's children. So when the Braisa says that you can't be mafsid the ksuba, we're really talking about this specific institution of benin dichrin. V'hachi k'tani, k'shem sh'amocheres ksubas ala acherim lo hefsida ksubas benin dichrin. Just like a person who sells their ksuba to somebody else doesn't lose out on the institution of benin dichrin, then after the death of the husband, we would still apply the din of benin dichrin. And my taima, why would we do that? If the woman sold the ksuba, maybe she should lose out on her rights to benin dichrin. So says the Gemara, because zuzi hudan sua, we assume the woman was just in a dire financial predicament, and that's why she had to sell the ksuba. But otherwise, she would not have sold it, and therefore, benin dichrin should still be valid. So kach mocheres ksubas alabayla lo hefsida ksubas benin dichrin. The same is true about a woman who sells her ksuba to her husband. That even if you sell your ksuba to your husband, you don't lose out on the institution of benin dichrin. My taima zuzi hu de ansua, because we assume that the reason that you had to sell your ksuba to your husband is because you really needed the money.
How would the benin dichrin made whole if their mother sold the ksuba?
How are the benin dichrin made?
They go to the, they motzi from the lekuchos?
I think so. They would be motzi from the lekuchos. Yeah. And Rashi says here, mafsid halokeach. Ava bichin lo hefsidu b'nei ksubas benin dichrin. Right. So basically, what Rashi is describing is, again, let's go back to our example. If Rachel was the one who sold her ksuba to somebody else, then the children of Leah can't say, "Oh, well, the fact that your mother sold her ksuba shows that benin dichrin doesn't apply anymore because she sold it, and the lekuchos, the person who bought the ksuba, would have gotten all the rights." No, we still say that the only reason Rachel had to sell her ksuba was because she really needed the money, but otherwise she wouldn't have sold it, and therefore the children are still entitled to benin dichrin, and presumably we'd be motzi miyad
lekuchos. In what circumstances would a woman sell her ksuba?
In what circumstances?
Yeah.
If she really needs the money for whatever reason, maybe.
Probably.
Yeah.
No, but her husband is required to support her. Why would she need to support
her? Right, her husband's required to support her, but we know that not always is the sustenance of the husband sufficient. There might be times, maybe she has certain extreme needs that the husband is not required to provide for, but she still needs. So she would go out and sell the ksuba just to earn, you know, a couple extra bucks. That seems to be the Gemara's assumption.
It's an unusual situation, okay.
So now the Gemara concludes its discussion over here with Lema Takanas Usha Tanaihi. Maybe this institution that we saw of Usha a subject of a machlokas tanaim. The Tani Chada, Avdei Melug Yotzin B'Shein Ba'ayin Le'isha Avalo Le'ish. One Brisa says that if you have servants which are Nichsei Melug, and they were to lose an eye or a tooth caused by the master, then they would be Yotze L'Cheres, but only Le'isha Avalo Le'ish. Only if the woman who really owns the Nichsei Melug caused it, and not if the husband caused that. The Tani Idach Lo Le'ish Below Le'ish. And the second Brisa says, the slaves would not go free in any event, neither if the husband was the one who injured them, nor if the woman was the one who injured them. So says the Gemara, Savrua de kule alma kinin peris lab kikinin ad guftami. The assumption is that both of these brisas, which have this discrepancy about whether the eved goes free if injured by the woman, let's assume that they both think that kinin peris is lab kikinin ad guftami. That the fact that the husband gets to eat the products produced by the slaves is not considered like a real ownership of the slaves. So my love, b'hakam iflagi, demanda amr le'isha, leis le'takanas yusha, umanda amr lo le'ish, below le'isha, is le'takanas yusha. So if you assume that everybody holds kinyan peres lavka kinyan aguktami, then isn't this machlokas between the brisas exactly a machlokas about whether we hold of takanas yusha? That the brisa, the first brisa, which says that if the isha injures the slaves, they go free, that's assuming that we do not hold of takanas yusha, and therefore the woman really has complete ownership over these slaves, and that's why they go free if she injures them, but not if the husband injures them. And the second brisa, which says the slaves do not go free whether they're injured by the husband or the wife, is assuming we do hold of the takana susha, therefore the husband really has control over the slaves, not complete control that would send them free, but the woman also does not have complete control since her husband has some rights to these slaves. So answers the Gemara, lo. The kule alma is lehu takana susha. Really, everybody does hold up takana susha. Ela kan kodem takana, kan la'achar takana. The brisa which said that they could go free if the woman injures them was before the takana was made, when the woman would still have complete rights to the slaves. And the brisa which says that they would not go free if the woman injures them is la'achar takana, after the takana susha was made, in which case the woman would not have complete rights over the slaves. Alternatively, you could say that idi la'achar takana, maybe both brisas are after the takana susha, the islihu takana susha, and they do hold of the takana susha. El lamanda amra le'isha below le'ish, my taima. Then how would you explain the brisa which says that if the woman injures the slaves, they would go free? If we're assuming that this is after the takana susha, and we hold of the takana susha, the woman shouldn't have complete ownership over the slaves, and they should not go free when she injures them. So answers the Gemara, the reason for that is kidurava. The amarava hektish chametz v'shichror machgiyin mide shibun. Rava has a din that if you are machdish something, you consecrate it to the Beis HaMikdash, or something becomes chametz, or something is a slave and it's freed, in all of those cases, that would remove these items, whatever the items are, presumably bread which becomes chametz on Pesach, or a slave which has gone free, or something which was declared to be hektish, that would be motzi midei shibun, that would automatically free it or remove it from whatever lien, whatever obligation it's tied to. So the brisa which says that the slaves would go free, and with this we'll conclude, the brisa which says that the slaves will go free when the woman injures them is assuming, like Rava, that the injury is motziyat miyad halakuchos miyad, whoever it's owned to. So even though the woman does not have complete control of the slaves, because takanas usha has been made and the husband does have rights to them, when the slaves are set free, that removes any rights that the husband has, and that's why the slaves automatically go free. Thank you very much.